People Rise Up. It is happening here, part 6. Listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we have part 6 of It Is Happening Here, a year-long look into the extent to which the United States government and society exemplifies each of 14 different characteristics of fascist states, as described in an article called Fascism Anyone, written by Lawrence Britt. We're going to be discussing the 5th characteristic today, and that is rampant sexism. Now, I know all the women out there are already going, oh, God, do you even have to talk about that? Isn't it obvious? And, well, it may or may not be obvious to some, but yes, we do have to talk about it because we're looking at all of them, some which seem more obvious than others. My guest this morning to discuss the issue of rampant sexism in the U.S. is Avis Jones DeWeaver. She is the director of Poverty Education and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And welcome to you. Thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, your areas of expertise in particular focus on primarily economic issues, and we're going to spend a good chunk of time talking about women's economic status. You look at issues related to social support programs, commonly referred to as welfare, poverty reduction strategies, and issues surrounding race and gender inequality, economic and otherwise. Mm-hmm. Now, the Institute, I would say, has recently released a Status of Women in the States report, Women's Economic Status in the United States. Can you just broadly summarize the position of women in the U.S. economy?
Sure. Well, very, very succinctly, I can say it's at the bottom. Most people don't realize that when you talk about low-wage work in America, you generally are talking about women's work. Women make up the majority of minimum wage workers, some 60% of minimum wage workers, and even worse than that, women make up over 90% of individuals who make $15,000 or less per year over their entire prime working years of life. That's 15 years or more of work. So women not only start out at the bottom more likely than men, they're much more likely than men to stay at the bottom over their entire working years. So in terms of where women are located in today's economy, especially those who don't have benefit of a college education, by and large, they're located quite solidly within the bottom realm.
Now, this report specifically looks at 6 different approaches to the economic issue. There's earnings, which is just absolute dollars in a calendar year. The earnings ratio, which many people probably have heard of, the idea that for every dollar a man makes, X number of cents actually is earned by women for comparable work. There's the issue of labor market segregation in that you know, women comprise the vast supermajority of some fields and yet have almost no representation in others. Then there's issues related to business ownership, and I suppose kind of related to that would be holding positions of power within businesses as opposed to the actual owning of like a small business, and then poverty. So why don't we just kind of dive through these somewhat. You mentioned regarding earnings that women typically earn less than men for comparable work. What's the ratio look like? Because I think that might be an easier way to conceptualize it for a lot of people.
Sure. Well, what most people think of in terms of this ratio, I'll kind of refer to, I think it's easy for people to understand this term that we often hear, and that's called the wage gap. So, for example, if we talk about that, we know that typically women earn about 77 cents for every dollar that a man makes. But if you look at what a woman earns over her entire working years, we've done some later work that looks at women and men over the 15 years of their highest earnings, and we are able to see how women position themselves over time, because we do hope that in American society, people have the opportunity to pull themselves up by the bootstraps, right? Whereas the wage gap kind of looks at one specific year in time. It's kind of measured every year. And our work that looks at women's earnings as a proportion of men's earning over time, we find that women only earn about 38% of what men earn over her prime working years. And so that's a wage gap of roughly 62% there. So it's much larger there than any one year measure that we could ever think to measure. So what's really sad about that is that women are working more now in today's society than they have in years past. Women are contributing a larger proportion of to their family's income than they have in the past. Families depend on women's work in order to survive in today's society. And unfortunately, women are not getting their due, and when women don't get their due, neither do families. In terms of this issue of occupational segregation, I think that's a particularly important issue to talk about as well, because it is true that if you look at the major occupational categories in the nation, the vast majority of them, at least 75% of them, are occupied by workers of one gender. So anytime you look at a particular field, usually it's either very much male-dominated or very much female-dominated, whereas women tend to be highly represented in things like low-level sales positions, service positions, clerks, administrative assistants, those sorts of things, where you might find more men in things like construction, for example, and certain, and even within the professional realm, women and men tend to fill different positions. You might find more women as teachers, for example, and more men as engineers. So there are differences there, and those differences are very much then replicated in terms of what the earnings are that are associated with those particular jobs. Who says that someone raising my child, a child care worker, for example, someone that's watching my child while I'm at work, who says that that person's value should be less than someone who's fixing my car, for example? But in terms of what we typically pay individuals, that's exactly what it works out being. And so we tend to, in essence, value the jobs that women do less as a society. As a result, women get paid less, and that creates a situation where they once again get stuck at the bottom of the economic ladder.
Now, it doesn't seem like any of that is a new phenomena, and in fact, I would imagine an argument could be made that in the past, say, 30 or so years, that the situation has been steadily improving to different extents based on, different types of occupations, and even within occupations. And just as a devil's advocate argument about this, is this really more just based on kind of a traditional view of labor split by gender, or is that not really accurate explain this?
It is true that, things have changed a lot over the years. There are more and more women in the workforce. More and more women have a college education now. In fact, the majority of people in college these days are women. So there are some people who make the argument that things are so much better, why shouldn't we just be happy in terms of where we are? But I think it's important to point out that we still aren't at a level playing field in society. If you look, for example, at a traditionally female area of work that most people think pays good money, for example, nursing, some of the work that we've done here at IWPR has shown, for example, that even within that female-dominated, comparatively high-paying professional field of nursing, male nurses still make significantly more than women nurses with the same amount of experience, the same credentials. So we still have this level of injustice in terms of how people are paid based on gender, even within an area that one would think that women would be advantaged. So we aren't quite there in terms of the promised land of providing equal opportunity for people across both race and gender, I would argue, in this society.
The sentiment you expressed of, if things have, things have been improving steadily to varying degrees in the past few decades, so why complain if the situation is in fact improving? And this is echoed, not echoed because it happened first. Susan Faludi's landmark book, Backlash, The Undeclared War Against American Women, released in 1991 and actually about to be reissued in a revised edition. Her introduction focuses on the Reagan era being just after the 80s when it was published. And she talks about that exact dynamic of, there has been this success. So why not just kind of be happy with, what's been achieved and not risk that by asking or demanding more? And I think she used the example of the inability to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed as an example of, the backlash, as she refers to it.
I would just have to say that it kind of reminds me of that letter that Dr. King wrote from the Birmingham jail, Why We Can't Wait. I think that while it's important to acknowledge where progress is made, and I'm not one to discount progress, I think it's also important to acknowledge where progress still needs to be made. And we are not doing ourselves, our families, and our daughters and their future husband and children any service by turning a blind eye to those areas that still need improvement in our society. We can only do good by them, by the women who are working today, and by those women and families of the future who will depend on women in the workplace and in broader society to make sure that our nation as a whole not only produces, does a better job of producing a level playing field in terms of where women stand in the economic ladder, but also just producing a more fair and just society in general. We just should not be satisfied with where we are now. I think we can do so much better and do so much more.
Now let's take a brief look here at the issue of business ownership, and I'm going to kind of throw into that the idea of, in kind of like larger corporations, the idea of women in management or directorates.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what women's situation in terms of, I guess it's primarily small business ownership and corporate managing.
Well, women are becoming, quite a significant force in terms of small business ownership. They are definitely becoming very, very aggressive and beginning to open up their own businesses and employ millions of people across this nation. But in terms of where we are versus where we need to be, I think we have a long way to go. Women need greater access to capital. They need greater access to those sort of social networks that provide them with the cushion that they need to be able to build strong businesses. And in terms of business women within already established businesses in terms of managerial and professional positions, I would argue that we still have a long way to go in this nation in terms of providing an environment that would allow women the opportunity to better be able to balance work and family demands. You know, as a result, we have a situation where, a lot of women, particularly those trying to, fulfill their societal roles at home in terms of being a mother, in terms of being a wife, and also fulfill their professional positions on the workplace, are just really, in essence, stressing themselves out because it's a situation where oftentimes they don't have a lot of flexibility in their work schedule. In fact, some work that we've done on the issue has shown that men tend to report greater flexibility in their work schedule than do women do. And we all know that in terms of traditionally how our society, how our families are structured in society, it's usually the women that have the bulk of child rearing and other sort of familial responsibilities. But once again, I think that's a reflection of the type of jobs that men hold that tend to have those sorts of perks versus the types of jobs that women hold. And also, I think sometimes when women do have those options opened up to them, because of our sort of gendered lens on issues, I think women feel like they're under greater scrutiny in the workplace. And if they were to take advantage of those opportunities, even if they're provided, that they might be looked down upon. They might be quicker to reach that glass ceiling than if they were to ignore those opportunities and instead, you know, fully commit themselves to the workplace without fully being able to commit themselves to the responsibilities that they have at home as well, without, you know, being able to reach some sort of happy medium. So I think it's both an issue of providing greater opportunities for people in terms of policies that we can implement, in terms of flexible work schedules, in terms of making it more easy for people to have child care that's more close to where they work, things of that nature, and also creating an environment where people can feel like it's okay to take advantage of those opportunities when they are made available to them, and they won't feel the backlash against them when the next good promotion comes up.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland, Oregon. My guest this morning is Avis Jones DeWeaver. She is the Director of Poverty, Education, and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and you can find out more about what they do online by visiting www.iwpr.org. And we are in the sixth program of a series I'm doing this year called It Is Happening Here, looking at characteristics of modern fascist states and the extent to which those characteristics are portrayed in the behavior of the American government and society. And we're talking about rampant sexism. We've focused primarily on economic issues thus far, and I just want to touch on the issue of women in poverty and your sense of the overall trend in women's progress in gaining equality economically with men, and then we'll get to as many other aspects of women's lives as we can in the remaining time.
Well, I would just say that in terms of women in poverty, I think one of the biggest issues that women face in terms of being able to pull themselves out of poverty is having access to higher education. And as I mentioned before, we're kind of like can look at two sides of the coin on this issue. On the one hand, we can say that on the good side, there are more women in college now than ever. Women, in fact, tend to outnumber men on most college campuses and tend to graduate at a higher rate than men once there. So they get there and they do well. Of those who are able to get there, they do well and they complete the schooling process, which really improves their future potential in terms of their earnings and really reduces dramatically the chance that they will ever live in poverty. On the other side of the coin, we do know that once in college, we once again see, I would say, major segregation in a sense, where women tend to be clustered in fields that tend to pay lower. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense. You might find much more women as education majors, for example, than as engineering majors. So I think we need to do a much better job with young girls as we are rearing them in the elementary school and maybe even in preschool to expand their horizons a bit in terms of what they may think is possible for them to achieve. And maybe in the future, we might see women more greatly represented in the math and society and the sciences fields that do provide greater earning potential. Also, on the other side of the coin, for those women who come from low-income families, we are seeing that they are having a tough time getting into college, and that's becoming tougher and tougher as tuition rates are increasing, as Pell Grant values are going down, as now student loan costs are going up. And so we are really quite concerned that for those women who are, and men, frankly, who are coming from low-income families who are seeking a higher education, that door is closing rapidly. And especially for those women who are recipients of welfare, we've seen rule changes as a result of welfare reform that have even more greatly constricted their opportunity to achieve higher education. So here we have a group of individuals who we have told, as a matter of public policy, you need to become self-sufficient, yet at the same time we are closing the greatest avenue they have towards self-sufficiency. To me, that is very short-sighted. It does nothing for those women. It does nothing for us as a society to not provide them with the tools that they need and that they want to be able to pull themselves and their children and their whole families out of the grips of poverty. So I think there's a lot more that we can do in those areas.
And the report that I'm referencing here, Women's Economic Status in the States, is available at the Institute for Women's Policy Research website, as well as many other reports that are full of all sorts of really fascinating research. So I encourage people to go and check those out on their own. Let's use your discussion of education as a bridge between economic issues and more political issues in terms of women being able to play a serious role in policy making that ultimately affects women.
Mm-hmm.
There's trends at the federal level that have kind of trickled down, for lack of a better phrase, to the state level in the past 25 or so years. I perceive it as really being launched with the Reagan administration in a concerted effort, and it always appears as though the spending cuts that are deemed necessary impact women more directly than men, in that they have to deal with kind of basic family supports, childcare, healthcare, access to education or food assistance, etc., etc. Can you give us a snapshot of maybe the past 25 years in that sense? Just federal.
Oh my God!
I know.
I'm sorry to laugh. I have to laugh to keep from crying, because it is amazing to me the all-out attack that has been waged on struggling women and families throughout this nation in the past 20 years, but most specifically within the past, I would say, even 8 years. It's been not quite eight, maybe about 6 years now since 2000 that we have seen a huge shift in our policy direction in terms of where we want to invest our money and where we want to take money from. And frankly speaking, what we're doing here as a matter of national policy is providing billions and billions of dollars in tax refunds, basically, and tax cuts to America's wealthiest citizens, primarily benefiting millionaires, while at the same time cutting by billions of dollars those programs that would help America's neediest citizens, things like housing assistance, things like health insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, for example, things like food assistance, food stamps even programs meant to help babies, women with infant children. WIC is supposed to be cut. I mean, it seems as if there is nothing that, this administration is not ashamed of cutting. And it's quite ironic that that's the case, given this sort of, come to Jesus moment that was experienced after the Katrina disaster, when President Bush kind of stood up in New Orleans and said, we must confront this poverty problem with bold action. Since then, what's happened is that they've cut even more than they were originally planning to cut. So we're at a position now where everything is on the chopping block. Child care assistance, job training programs, everything you can imagine that could be cut to meet the needs of America's poor and working families either has been cut or is about to be cut if the next round of budget cuts, in fact, do go through. So it seems like there is no sense of broader social responsibility that is exemplified by our policy directions at the moment, definitely within the past 20 years, but I would say even exceedingly so within the past 60 years. And it's quite ironic to me that that's the case, because it seems that after Katrina, we had a brief moment in time in this society where we began to at least talk about the issue of poverty in America, and there was a lot of lip service paid about that on Capitol Hill, but there has been nothing, and I repeat, nothing done of any substance to attack the poverty problem in America, even after we've seen what can happen when we leave people with nothing to fend for themselves in the midst of a disaster, that has not shamed us into action. And if anything, all that it's done is produced a greater urgency to get through everything that possibly can get through before, you know, change comes, hopefully, in the upcoming elections that would further line the pockets of millionaires.
Now, we've got about 4 minutes left here, and you referenced the past 6 years, the administration of George W. Bush, but it certainly didn't start there.
Oh, of course not.
And I'm curious if you can give a brief assessment of sort of the same question specific to the Clinton years, because a lot of people think, oh, you know, he was a Democrat, he would have been fine, but the 1996 welfare reform bill,
that was his idea.
That was his idea. He signed it. He championed it. And many other things along those lines. So just a quick assessment of Bill Clinton's efforts in this way.
Exactly. I mean, most people don't realize that, well, maybe they do, but maybe we forget after time that, you know, it was Clinton who was running on this whole, you know, this slogan of changing welfare as we know it. And as in the process of doing that, it was really that shift that led to the situation that we have now in terms of women and families now being sanctioned off welfare with no sort of safety net to catch them. Even those people who were, once again, impacted by Katrina has not received any sort of exemptions in terms of those welfare sanctionings or being just dropped off the welfare rolls for the rest of their lives. In addition to that, there was, I would argue, a great concentration on, you know, what can we do to maybe look like we're getting sort of tough on these issues, and as a result, it's created a situation that we have now, where many individuals who are on welfare and want to be able to get themselves and their families out of poverty by way of higher education aren't able to do so because of the rule changes that were put into effect in that administration. And so it's created a very difficult situation for individuals to really be able to pull themselves out of poverty. Also included in that original legislation was this information about strengthening families and having a focus on two-parent families, which this administration has then run with in terms of investing billions of dollars in marriage promotion programs in lieu, I would argue, of a real poverty reduction strategy. So that's not an idea that the Bush administration came up with. They were using language that was already in welfare reform, and that was put in there under the Clinton administration. So, you know, definitely it's not just this one administration that has tipped the scales there. Although things, I think, have rapidly gone downhill even further most recently. But definitely, I would agree with you that starting with the Reagan administration, in fact, where we had this sort of the beginnings of the ideals of the implementation of trickle-down economics, we've just seen a continuation of that sort of, you know, unproven sort of approach towards giving to the rich with the idea that it will eventually help everyone else. And unfortunately, we're still waiting for that theology to pay off.
Avis, I wish we had another half hour so we could get into this level of detail with issues surrounding family and mothering, as you referenced earlier, time flexibility and leisure time, issues related to personal safety as it regards women, but we don't, unfortunately.
Oh, that went by really quickly. I'm sorry.
It does do that. I really appreciate you being on the program today to talk about primarily the economic and political aspects of sexism against women in this country. So thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Avis Jones-DeWeaver is the Director of Poverty, Education, and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. You can find out more about them online at www.iwpr.org. Thanks once again.
Thank you.
And that's going to wrap up show number 6 of It Is Happening Here. We talked about rampant sexism today, characteristic number 5. We got 9 more to go between now and the end of the year. You can find more about this program at the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm. I'm not totally certain how it is that you'll find my page since our redesign, but if you go to archive.org, go to the Open Source Audio Archive there, and search for my name, Andrew Geller. It will bring up a page where you can find the audio for this program and a link back to the KABU page, which is unfortunately the simplest way for you to get there at this point in time. I appreciate you listening to the program. If you got any comments or questions about this or any other show I've done, please feel free to send me an email, kboo@riseup.net. Thank you very much for listening to the program. Coming up next, local activist Will Seaman interviews John Miller. John Miller is the national coordinator of the East Timor and Indonesia Action Network. They'll be discussing the current crisis in East Timor.